From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Humankind has long been captivated by the planet Mars. Recent discoveries made by various probes, orbiters, and rovers that have been exploring the red planet over the past 50 years have made many of us quite excited about the possibility of someday sending humans to visit our neighbor in the solar system. The excitement about the exploration of Mars reached a high point recently when NASA scientists announced a remarkable discovery. This is Jim Green, the Director of Planetary Science at NASA.
Mars is not the dry, arid planet that we thought of in the past. Today we're going to announce that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found on Mars.
Today we talk about the past, present, and future of the exploration of Mars. We'll talk with guests from NASA here in Washington and at the Space Agency's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. We'll also be joined by the president of the Mars Society, a group that works to inform and educate people on the benefits of exploring Mars and creating a permanent human presence on the red planet. In our first segment, we look back at the exploration of Mars conducted in the past. We're joined by Eric Conway, who is an historian at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Eric, let's begin with the first successful NASA probe that was sent to Mars. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the first successful NASA mission was JPL's Mariner 4 spacecraft, which did its flyby of Mars in 1965.
And what about earlier missions? I understand the Soviets sent some probes out starting in 1960.
Yes, the Soviets tried very hard to be the first explorers of Mars. They sent a whole series of spacecraft out, and in fact, they managed to be the first to touch the surface of Mars. They had landers descend in 1971, but they actually failed before touchdown, with one exception that lived for a few seconds, sent back enough telemetry so that they knew it touched down and then failed. So the Soviets tried very hard, but they were not particularly successful.
Tell us a little bit about the first successful NASA probe, Mariner 4.
It was on a flyby trajectory of Mars, passed by in 1965. It carried a video camera, and it returned 21 images, grayscale, of course, in that era. It had the distinction of being the first digital data return spacecraft that NASA flew.
I understand Mariner 9 was an important mission. Can you tell us about this and why Mariner 9 was such an important milestone?
Mariner 9 was the first successful planetary orbiter, and it was designed to do a photographic mapping of the entire surface at a resolution kind of bigger than a football field. So it couldn't see small things, only large ones. And it also carried instrumentation for various other sorts of things, radio occultation for atmospheric science, and et cetera. And so its import, though, was really it was the first time a spacecraft carried a propulsion system to successfully go into orbit of around another planet. Obviously, Lunar Orbiter had done the same thing for Earth's moon, so it was a follow-on to that kind of concept. It changed the way scientists saw Mars. Before, they had kind of seen Mars as lunar, with lots and lots of cratering, not a lot of valley systems. And Mariner 9 really changed all that. It showed what appeared clearly to be water-carved channels, again, the giant valley system. It demonstrated that Mars has enormous topographic relief, much greater than Earth appears to, is the discoverer of the giant volcanoes that we now call Olympus Mons.
After the Mariner missions, the Viking missions began, I believe, in the mid-70s. Now, what was the difference between the two missions, and what were some of the goals of Viking?
Viking project history is actually a little more complicated. It started with the name Voyager in, actually, the early 1960s. It's intended, actually, to be launched on a Saturn-class launch vehicle, the Saturn V. It got far too expensive and was ultimately canceled and replaced by the mission we now know as Viking to go on a smaller launch vehicle. And essentially, the goals of the Viking project, and here I have to give some credit to the rest of NASA, because NASA Langley Research Center was actually the leader of that effort. JPL built the orbiters and operated the orbiters and landers when they got to Mars. The goals of the project were to first orbit Mars, find safe landing places via orbital imaging, and drop a pair of robotic landers onto the surface safely.
Let's move into the 90s. What about some of the 90s orbiters? Tell us about one of the first ones.
Well, kind of the kickoff of the United States' return to Mars was supposed to be Mars Observer, which has become famous for vanishing 3 days before it was supposed to go into Mars orbit. It had several follow-on missions to recover its science. The first was Mars Global Surveyor, arrived in 97, as I recall, and two more missions carried the rest of the Mars Observer instrumentations. The Mars Odyssey carried one instrument, the gamma ray spectrometer, and Mars Climate Orbiter, and then finally the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter finished, ultimately, recovery of the Mars Observer science.
I understand that one or perhaps both of the Mars orbiters were credited with helping scientists find flowing water on Mars.
There's kind of a whole backstory to this. There have been previous announcements of the findings that there are kind of these gullies on Mars that have an albedo shift. In other words, their appearance changes over time. What this latest finding did was add the evidence from spectroscopy that there are hydrated minerals associated with that changing albedo shift, and that's the product of the CRISM instrument on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
Let's talk a little bit about the rovers.
So the first successful planetary rover was the Little Sojourner rover on Mars Pathfinder. So the Mars Pathfinder lander's job was primarily atmospheric science. The rover's job was to sample the local area, again with an alpha proton X-ray spectrometer, for mineralogical purposes. And so its findings were to give an indication of the mineralogy of the Pathfinder landing site.
And, of course, the next step was the Mars Exploration Rover mission, which I believe were actually two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. And I understand between the Spirit and Opportunity, one is continuing its mission.
Yes, one has survived for more than, let's see, what year is this? It's on its 11th year on Mars. It's very impressive.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about historical look, a look back at exploration of Mars conducted by NASA over the years. I really appreciate it.
I hope it was interesting for you.
Let's take a short break. We'll be back with our next program segment after this.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
We're back with the science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Today we're talking about Mars exploration in the past, present, and future. In this segment, we're going to talk about NASA's next Mars mission, the Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy and Heat Transport Mission, or InSight for short. Joining me to talk about it is Bruce Bannert. He's InSight's principal investigator and research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Bruce, could you please tell us about some of the goals and objectives of the InSight mission?
Well, we're going to be going to Mars to map out the deep interior of Mars, sort of provide a roadmap of what the inside of the planet is made of, all the way from the surface, all the way down to the very center of the planet in the middle of the core. And by understanding the structure of the planet, we hope to understand better how it was formed back in the first few tens of millions of years in the planet's history, so the first few ticks of the clock in the birth of the planet.
Can you tell us about the InSight spacecraft and its instruments and what their function is?
What we're really looking at is the global structure of the planet. And so basically anywhere we are on the planet, and you know, if you look straight down with our instruments, we'll see what we need to see. You know, we'll be able to see the core, we'll be able to see the crust. And so we like to stay in one place and be very quiet. And that's because our instruments are essentially long-term listening instruments. The main instrument is a seismometer that measures the shaking of the planet whenever there's a Mars quake, similar to an earthquake on the Earth. And we use that shaking from the waves that have traveled through the planet from the Mars quake to our sensor to be able to use those waves as a kind of an X-ray probe of the inside of the planet. So as those waves move through the planet, they change their character based on the kinds of rocks that they pass through. And we scientists can then analyze the waves and sort of unravel that whole path and understand the composition of the planet that they've moved through. And in order to do that, we need everything else to be very quiet. So we don't want our spacecraft to be moving around. So in fact, we actually put the spacecraft to sleep for about 22 out of the 24 hours of the day so that it's extremely quiet and it doesn't disturb our seismometer.
Geologically speaking, can you give us a bit of a comparison between Mars and Earth and how they differ?
Well, Mars is about half the size of the Earth in terms of radius, and so it's a much smaller planet. Although, if you look at the amount of land area, we have about the same amount of land area on Earth as we do on Mars, since most of the Earth is actually covered with water. So, if you wanted to go and explore Mars on foot, you'd have about as hard a time as you would to explore the entire Earth on foot. Because it's small, it's actually less geologically active. Sort of the amount of energy that was stored inside the planet at formation, a lot of that energy has been able to sort of seep out and radiate to space over the life of the planet. And that's why we think that we can measure the character of the inside of the planet and still be able to use that to infer a lot of things about the birth of the planet, things that have been erased on the Earth by plate tectonics and vigorous mantle convection and volcanism and things like that.
As we know from the history of the Earth was basically shaped and formed over the years by such events such as tectonics and volcanism. Did Mars go through the same process?
We don't think that Mars ever experienced plate tectonics, or if it did, it was for a very, very short time early in its history. We don't know exactly why that's the case. We have some theories, and one of the things we want to do is test those theories by looking at the thickness of the Martian crust and the detailed composition of it to see whether it could have easily been initiated into plate tectonics. For example, some of the reasons why it might not have had plate tectonics is the crust may be actually too light and too buoyant to be able to be subducted back down into the Martian mantle the way the Earth's crust is subducted at the mid-ocean trenches on the Earth. And so there are a lot of geological questions like that that we think that we can answer by measuring the composition of the interior of Mars.
To draw attention to the InSight mission officials recently invited members of the general public to send their names to Mars. Can you tell us about this a bit, and what kind of response did you get?
Oh, we got a great response. So we are collected names from people that wanted to send their names to Mars, and we had them all engraved on a microchip, which is going to be glued onto the outside of the lander and will actually be on Mars when we land. We put out that invitation, and we got many, many, I don't even know what the number is, but I think it was many hundreds of thousands of names from all over the world, not just the United States or the partner countries, but from Europe, Asia, Australia, South America, North America, all the different continents of the world. We got a huge response, and everybody who responded got a boarding pass, so everyone who has their name going to Mars has a boarding pass like you get to get on an airplane that shows that they're participating in our mission.
Bruce Bannert, thanks so much for joining us today and filling us in on the upcoming InSight mission to Mars.
It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. Our topic is the exploration of Mars, past, present, and future. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA, or you can send us a good old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. My next guest on today's program is Robert Zubrin, who is the president and one of the founders of an advocacy group called the Mars Society, based in Lakewood, Colorado. As a part of its mission, the Mars Society works to inform and educate members of the public, as well as the media and government, on the benefits of exploring Mars and creating a permanent human presence on the red planet. Robert Zubrin, NASA scientists recently announced some rather significant news concerning the exploration of the planet Mars. They said that they found evidence of potentially life-holding water. Now, what are your thoughts on this finding, and what is its significance?
This discovery had been foreshadowed. We had some of this data in 2011, and even some people theorized based on observations in 2001 that this was going on. But what's new here is that it's been confirmed, and not just in one or two places, but as a widespread phenomena spanning the whole planet. So there's not just liquid water occasionally in one place on Mars. There's liquid water in lots of places on Mars and with some frequency. And so that means, yes, there could be extant life on Mars in a water table that these seeps are coming out of. There's plenty of microbial life in underground water on Earth. There could be so on Mars. And furthermore, we can get to it relatively easily because in our samples of this water containing some of these microbes, presumably if they're there, are coming out onto the surface. We don't even have to drill to reach it. Now, you might do better by drilling. You might get actual alive organisms. If they're on the surface, they're dead. Still, this is huge. And if there is life on Mars, that would prove there's life throughout the universe. It would prove that the development of life from chemistry, wherever you have appropriate physical and chemical conditions, is a lawful scientific process that occurs with high probability wherever such conditions exist. And since we now know there's planets everywhere, it means life's everywhere. And if there's life everywhere, it means intelligent life is plentiful, because the whole history of life on Earth is one of development from simpler forms to more complex forms, manifesting greater capacities for activity and intelligence and, in fact, ever more rapid evolution. So we go to Mars, we can find out if we're not alone.
What would you say to someone when they say, we don't understand why there has to be a concentration on sending people to Mars or even continuing space exploration? Why do you think it's important we go to Mars?
There's the science, there's the challenge, there's the future, and there is grappling with the issues that we face in the world today. Mars is the Rosetta Stone for letting us know the truth about the prevalence and diversity of life in the universe. It's something that people have wondered about for thousands of years. Mars can give us the answer. There's the challenge. Civilizations, like people, we grow and we challenge ourselves. And a humans to Mars program would be a tremendously productive challenge to every country participating. I mean, let's take one important example. We've got a crisis in education in this country. How about humans to Mars? How about saying to every kid in this country, as we did with Apollo, learn your science and you could be a pioneer and explorer of new worlds. Youth loves adventure. Let's make science the great adventure. You do that, you'll get millions of scientists. Okay, you get scientists by exciting kids about science and what they can do if they become a scientist or an engineer or an inventor. So that's what this would do. This would solve one of our most important problems in this country and the world, creating the intellectual capital to continue to advance society. Then there's the future. If we do what we can do in our time, we can create new branches of human civilization.
Dr. Zubrin, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
NASA recently released a detailed outline of its future Mars exploration plans in its report, NASA's Journey to Mars, Pioneering Next Steps in Space Exploration. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden said that the space agency is closer to sending American astronauts to Mars than at any point in our history. Our final guest on today's program is Greg Williams. He is the Deputy Associate Administrator for NASA's Human Exploration and Operations Missions Directorate here in Washington, D.C. He tells us about NASA's plan for the future of Mars exploration, including what would be involved in sending humans to the red planet. Greg, why is it important that we send a human being to Mars?
There's nothing like having a human on the surface of the planet, actually more than one human. And the reasons are a couple-fold. One is, the human brain and the human eye are much faster processors than anything we have in terms of computing or sensing capability. And you can imagine just seeing a vista of the Grand Canyon in person is much more, I think, awe-inspiring. You can assimilate much more information. You really get a sense of what's there more than if you had a video camera recording it for you and then watching it at home on your television. The experience is vastly different. And decision-making also is a big factor. There's nothing like having a geologically trained person on site to decide which samples to collect, for example. Robots are good or getting better at manipulating objects and even doing primitive chemical analysis. But there's nothing like having a human scientist on the surface being able to choose one object over another for sample collection, or even to interpret in near real time what it is that he or she is looking at. It's a vastly different experience in terms of both the visceral human experience and also the scientific productivity of the endeavor.
NASA Administrator Charles Bolden recently laid out a detailed framework of a plan to put an American astronaut or American astronauts on Mars. Now, this plan will be implemented in three phases. Can you give us an idea of what needs to be done to fully implement this plan?
The three phases you're referring to, we describe them as Earth-reliant, as the proving ground, and as Earth-independent. What we'll need to be is be able to be Earth-independent one day, be able to operate, because the time delay of transmission of communications between the Earth and Mars can be significant, can be several minutes in length, and that's critical for operations. And so you want to start off in an Earth-reliant, which we're doing today with the International Space Station, and here's where we're actually learning to live and work in space for long periods of time. There's a lot to be done there, not only learning how to operate in microgravity environments, but being able to operate safely and to be able to sustain crew health and productivity over long periods of time. We're currently running what we call the one-year mission with astronauts Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko on orbit. They've just passed their halfway mark in that. We're going to learn a great deal about how to improve human health and productivity for long durations. We need to do that in an Earth-reliant frame where return times are measured in minutes to an hour if we have something were to happen, and so we prove out our operations there. Then we want to move from that Earth-reliant frame to what we call a proving ground phase. Here we're taking advantage of the fact that we have this large natural satellite, the Moon, to provide an environment to go to in which return times are measured in days to a week. And so there, you want to be able to practice the kind of deep space operations you would need to do at Mars or at an asteroid in its native orbit. And in that proving ground era, we call it the proving ground because you're really demonstrating that you have the capability to operate at long distances from the Earth. And we want to move from Earth-reliant through this proving ground phase to then an Earth-independent phase where you're in the vicinity of Mars or an asteroid in its native orbit, where return times are measured in months or even a year or more. That takes this kind of progression to be able to achieve. And so we think we've got a program that's logically laid out to do that. And we think that stepwise approach makes sense in terms of advancing our technological capability, but also practicing in an operational environment for long-duration human spaceflight.
You know, Greg, this sounds a lot like the steps that were taken to prepare humans to land on the Moon. Very reminiscent of that, including some of the side missions that need to be accomplished first. You had mentioned trips to Mars itself, perhaps in low Mars orbit, or perhaps orbiting one of the moons of Mars. What about the role of the ARM mission, the Asteroid Redirect Mission, and are there plans to really do some more exploration of the Moon before moving on to Mars?
We believe the Asteroid Redirect Mission is going to be really helpful in our long-term journey to Mars. It's important to put it in its proper context, which is that it is one of several missions that will take place in this proving ground phase. ARM is a mission to go out and robotically capture a near-Earth asteroid in its native orbit, redirect it into a stable orbit around the Moon, and then visit that object in the vicinity of the Moon with astronauts. In that latter phase, it's just one of several crewed missions to the cislunar space, to that proving ground, that will allow us to demonstrate things like deep space automated rendezvous and docking, again, extravehicular activity or spacewalks. We're going to send astronauts. They will dock with the Asteroid Redirect robotic mission. They will emerge from the Orion spacecraft in their extravehicular suits, encounter the asteroid. They will acquire samples from the asteroid and bring them back into Orion and bring them back to Earth. So you can imagine there are a lot of things that are going to be accomplished and demonstrated in that mission that we're going to need if we're going to operate in the vicinity of Mars, if we're going to encounter Mars moons, if we're going to have to do spacewalks in deep space. And then the other thing that ARM is going to give us is a in-space propulsion capability. We need to be able to move a spacecraft around in deep space, and that requires propulsion systems that are different inherently than the kind you use to get from Earth's surface to Earth orbit. And so ARM is going to use a new high-powered solar electric propulsion capability, and we will demonstrate that capability first on ARM. We've used solar electric power before, but never at these high-power levels. We'll demonstrate this capability for ARM, and that will be the capability that we will use to move cargo masses from cislunar space to Mars, for example. to pre-position cargo for future human missions. So ARM is has an important role to play in the whole broader Journey to Mars strategy. With respect to the moon, we expect cislunar space to be not just a place to demonstrate that we can operate in deep space, but actually as a staging area in which we would send human crews and cargo to cislunar space.
Greg, can we explain what cislunar space is?
Yes, thank you. It's a new word for me, too, when I came to this job. Cislunar space is the volume of space around the moon. So it includes the moon, and it includes lunar orbit, but it's essentially the region of space that encompasses the moon. And the reason why that's important is that the laws of gravitation are such that with the Earth and the moon in their gravitational relationship, there are stable orbits around the moon that allow for low energy transfers from one location in space to another. And so it makes it a useful place in which to operate.
I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, if you don't mind, Greg, but what are some of the key challenges that still need to be resolved before we can move forward in sending humans to Mars?
There are several, and they're ones that we think we have a pathway on for pretty much all of them. We need to do some technology development work, but they include the in-space propulsion that I mentioned earlier. They include protection from radiation environment. Deep space is outside of the Earth's magnetic field, and therefore crews in deep space are subject to cosmic rays that come in the natural background of the universe, and also the solar flares and so on from the sun. So there's radiation protection. There's finding the right balance between what you want to carry with you from Earth versus what you want to use in the environment you're going to. We refer to that latter as in situ resource utilization. In other words, learning to, for example, extract water and oxygen from the Martian surface and atmosphere to make your own water and oxygen, not only for human breathing and use, but also to make your own rocket fuel so you don't have to carry all the fuel for the return journey with you when you go. So in situ resource utilization is a big deal. Advanced spacesuits for EVA is a big deal. There are a whole list of those that we have detailed in the document that we put out. I hope you have access to. They include habitats not only in space but on the surface of Mars or one of Mars' moons, the ability to move around once you're on the surface, the ability to generate power, the ability to what we call entry, descent, and landing, to be able to land large masses on the Martian surface, but then not only do that but to be able to take off again. The Mars rovers, which were very, very successful, that technology, we're operating at the limits of that technology with respect to the entry, descent, and landing through the Martian atmosphere onto the surface. The Curiosity rover is about a metric ton. 1 to 2 metric tons is about the limit of that capability. We need to be able to land 5 or 8 or 15, or some people think even up to 25 or 27 metric tons on the surface. That's going to require different technologies. So we're working on that today as well. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the ascent off the Martian surface is going to require an ability to store, to manufacture, to be able to propellant load, and do all the things that you'd have to do to conduct a launch operation from another planetary body. So again, lots of challenges to overcome, but there are technology pathways that have been identified for each of those.
I got one final question for you, Greg, if you don't mind. Currently, at this point, what do you see, when do you see a human being stepping foot on Mars?
Wow, that's a good question, a hard one to predict. The goal we've been given is to be able to send humans to the vicinity of Mars in the 2030s, and so that means being able to go to the moons of Mars, to Mars orbit. To be able to get down, so that we wanted to be able to do that in the 2030s, to be able to put a human on the surface, that's really going to depend on what technology challenges we overcome, what international and commercial partnerships we entrain, and what funding is available, what economic conditions pertain in the 2020s and 2030s. Those things make it difficult to say, okay, we think we can put a human on the surface by X date. So we're going to bite it off one chunk at a time. We're going to have humans in cislunar space in the mid-2020s, and we're going to have humans at the vicinity of Mars, in Mars orbit and so on, in the mid-2030s. When we get to the surface is a fact. It depends on those three things I mentioned to you.
Greg Williams, thank you so much for taking time to give us an outline on the future plans of sending humans to Mars. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
And that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank the people who helped engineer this program: Eva Nanichka, Keith Holmes, Rob McLean, Linus Rimkus, and Dan Crafton. The science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington, D.C. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Join us again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.